From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. The Sopranos begins season 4 on HBO this Sunday. On today's Fresh Air, we feature interviews with actors Dominique Chianese, who plays Uncle Junior, Edie Falco, Carmela Soprano, and Stephen Van Zandt, whose role is hitman Silvio Dante. Also, TV critic David Bianculli tells us about the new season. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the new theatrical release of the 1927 classic German silent film, Metropolis. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Colin Powell met with other members of the UN Security Council today to discuss new resolutions on securing Iraq's compliance on disarmament. Yesterday, President Bush challenged the Security Council to enforce its demands and said action against Iraq was unavoidable if the UN fails. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports from New York.
A senior State Department official says Secretary Powell will work with other Security Council members next week to draft the language of the resolutions. The U.S., the official says, wants the resolutions to spell out how Iraq is in defiance of the UN, what Iraq must do to come into compliance with a deadline for doing so, and the consequences of failure to comply. On the second day of debate by the UN General Assembly, Iraq received little public support. European Union officials said Iraq must not be allowed any more delays in accepting the return of UN weapons inspectors. Even Russia, which often is sympathetic to Iraq, said Baghdad must comply with the UN or assume responsibility for the consequences. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, New York.
Officials in Florida say they found no evidence of terrorist activity after detaining three young men. The men were stopped last night after a woman in a Georgia restaurant said she overheard them discussing what she thought was a possible terrorist attack. The three men were medical students from Jordan, Iran, and Pakistan. Police stopped the men near Naples, Florida, and closed down the state's major east-west highway for more than 17 hours while they used dogs and a robot to search the men's two cars for explosives. Muslim groups and the men's families said police overreacted. The nation's top military officer reported today Iraq has mobile laboratories for making chemical or biological weapons. General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said the labs will make it easier for the Iraqi regime to hide their weapons from inspectors. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
A senior defense official briefing reporters at the Pentagon said Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein is now using tractor-trailer trucks to house biological weapon laboratories. When asked about the allegation later, the Joint Chiefs Chairman, General Richard Myers, said there is evidence that Iraq has what Myers says is a mobile production capability for biological and chemical weapons.
It does not take a lot of space for some of this work to go on. It can be done in a very, very small location. And the fact that you can put it on wheels makes it a lot easier to hide from people that might be looking for it.
The senior defense official speaking at the Pentagon said a mobile biological weapons facility could be set up in 3 to 5 trailers and would be capable of making significant amounts of weapons material. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 67 points to close at 8,312 in heavy trading. For the week, the Dow was down 114 points. This is NPR News. Police in southern Mexico have arrested members of a paramilitary group blamed for hundreds of murders. NPR's Jerry Haddon reports from Mexico City.
25 members of the alleged paramilitary group called Peace and Justice have been picked up by police in the southern state of Chiapas. Authorities also seized several weapons in raids. Peace and Justice has long been accused of killing Indians and others opposed to their local political bosses. In particular, the Zapatista rebels have blamed Peace and Justice for hundreds of attacks since 1994, when that rebel group rose up against the Mexican government, demanding greater rights for Indians. In the last several months, violent attacks against Zapatista supporters have been on the rise. Peace and Justice's leaders maintain they are a nonviolent political organization. The group has ties to some factions of the former Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, which controlled Mexico for 7 decades until losing power in 2000. Jerry Haddon, NPR News, Mexico City.
A federal judge in Chicago has dismissed charges against an Islamic charity that was accused of lying about its connections to Osama bin Laden. The assets of the Benevolence International Foundation have been frozen since mid-December when federal agents raided its headquarters. The group and its executive director, Enam Arnaut, were accused of committing perjury in a sworn statement filed in a civil lawsuit in which they said they didn't fund people or organizations known to engage in violence or terrorist activities. Arnaut has been in jail since April. He has acknowledged making contact with Osama bin Laden but denies any connection to terrorism. In stocks today, the Nasdaq gained 12 points, or just under 1%, to close at 1,291. The Nasdaq lost 4 points for the week. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Amundsen Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. After 16 months between original episodes, the HBO drama series The Sopranos finally returns this weekend to launch its fourth season. TV critic David Bianculli says it was worth the wait, especially with a below-average crop of new fall TV series just around the corner.
Just about everybody wants to talk to me about The Sopranos, and there are a few things they want to know and a lot of things they don't want to know. What they want to know most is, have I seen it? Yes, at least the first four episodes of this new fourth season. They also want to know, is it as good? Yes. Yes, it is. What they don't want to know is just about everything else. They don't want to know what happens, which is another indication of just how much fun and how eagerly anticipated this show is. I wouldn't be at all surprised if the fourth season premiere of The Sopranos shatters all previous ratings records for a cable TV series. The buzz is that strong, and the wait has been that long. And you know what? People aren't asking me about any other TV show this fall. Last year at this time, I was all excited about Alias on ABC and another spy series, 24, on Fox. This year, I'm not really thrilled about any of the new shows. And apparently, neither is anybody else. The Sopranos is so much better. It's partly because David Chase, who created The Sopranos, knows how to introduce and develop fascinating, complicated, eccentric, and totally believable characters. He did it on Northern Exposure, he did it on I'll Fly Away, and he did it as long ago as when he was a writer on The Rockford Files and Kolchak the Night Stalker. I think it's also because The Sopranos is so good at doing what the broadcast networks aren't doing much of anymore. Even though each episode of The Sopranos contains a payoff of some sort, its stories stretch out over several episodes and even several seasons. It's unpredictable in the best sense. Even people we care about deeply can die or show a frightening dark side at any moment. Shows like Hill Street Blues and Saint Elsewhere used to do that regularly. Now it's done on a few network series, Alias, 24, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but not many. The trend, instead, is for safer, more self-contained dramas, so that the shows aren't asking too much of the audience. Not to have to watch each week, and not even to care that much. The Sopranos flies in the face of all that. Yes, its placement on cable is perfect, because the freedom to present more graphic language, violence, and sex is integral to this series, just as it is with another HBO series, Oz. But most of all, The Sopranos works because of the writing and acting. Character gets as much emphasis as plot, and this allows terrific actors to do some great work. James Gandolfini and Edie Falco, as Tony and Carmela Soprano, are at the center of an incredibly gifted acting ensemble. The talent extends to the actors portraying such minor characters as Bobby, the overweight soprano mobster who serves as caretaker to Tony's ailing uncle Junior. Here are Tony and Bobby talking at a diner counter in a scene that gives away absolutely nothing about the plot of the season opener, but which shows just why The Sopranos is such a delight. It made me laugh out loud about a subject I never thought I could laugh about. Bobby is played by Steve Sciarrippa.
Arm really went downhill after the World Trade Center. You know, Quasimodo predicted all this.
Who did what?
All these problems, the Middle East, the end of the world.
Nostradamus. Quasimodo's the hunchback of Notre Dame.
Oh, right. Notre Dame.
Nostradamus and Notre Dame. It's two different things completely.
It's interesting, though, to be so similar, isn't it? Then I always thought, okay, hunchback at Notre Dame. You also got your quarterback and your halfback at Notre Dame.
What's a cathedral?
Obviously, I know. I'm just saying. It's interesting, the coincidence. What? You gonna tell me you never pondered that? The back thing with Notre Dame?
No.
These first four episodes are full of surprises, shocks, and subtle turns. A touch here or a remark there end up having very large consequences. The Sopranos plays out like a novel, and the next chapters have finally arrived. I tell you not to miss them, but if you're like any of my friends, you've already got your night planned.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Dominic Chianese was nominated for an Emmy last year for his role as Uncle Junior in The Sopranos. You might remember him for his performance in Godfather 2 as Johnny Ola. Chianese is also a singer. He has a new CD called Hits, which features Italian and American songs, including a couple of originals. Terry spoke with him last year. On The Sopranos, Uncle Junior is often at odds with his nephew Tony Soprano, with Junior representing the old way of doing things. Junior has even taken out a hit on Tony, which failed. Here's a scene from the final episode of this past season. Uncle Junior is talking with Tony, played by James Gandolfini. Junior has just been released from house arrest.
Well, Bobby says you're out from under the house arrest. Congratulations.
The lawyer was finally able to demonstrate I don't pose a flight risk. Flight risk. I've been farting into the same sofa cushion for the last 18 months. Your week or trial's coming up, though.
At least you're out. Then you're eating regular food again.
An illness changed my whole viewpoint. I'm gonna stop and smell the roses.
We all should.
Dominic Chianese, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's so nice. Aria fresca.
Let's talk a little bit about your role on The Sopranos.
Sure.
Why don't you describe your character?
Okay, he's grouchy, tunnel vision kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
Very opinionated about certain things, and he's kind of a likable guy in a lot of ways, and he has some funny expressions sometimes.
Now, in your role as Uncle Junior, you wear these big black plastic rectangular eyeglasses.
Yes.
I think those eyeglasses really change your look. It changes your face. It changes your eyes.
Yeah, it does. And that's very important, as you know, in film. You know. No, it really does. And to me, I love them because they're a mask. And I don't think I can do Uncle Junior without them now. They're really a part of his mystique.
Is there a character who Uncle Junior reminds you of in real life who you can draw on to create Uncle Junior?
Yes, definitely. There are people in my own family who had great senses of humor and funny lines and they were just natural comedians. And there were a load in my neighborhood, people like that, including my own father. My father, once in a while, would throw a line out, you know, that would be quite funny, sotto voce kind of, you know, deadpan kind of thing. You get that a lot, I think, in Italian-American culture. I noticed that a lot with uncles and things.
What kind of neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up in that kind of very working-class neighborhood in the Bronx, you know, on Arthur Avenue, where there was everybody, the butcher, the bakers, the candlestick makers, the doctors, the lawyers. But most of the people were plasterers, bricklayers, store owners, you name it.
Did you grow up thinking that there were a lot of wise guys in the neighborhood?
Well, I didn't have to think about it. You'd see them hanging out in the corners. They had hats, and my father would point them out to me. Those are racketeers, he would call them, you know, because I'd ask, you know. They're racketeers. That's all he would say. Yeah, they're racketeers. And I figured they were shooting crap in the streets, shooting dice. But when I was a little boy, you could see police cars stop sometime near the public school, and you're on the way to school, and all these guys would be running away from this unmarked police car. People would be chasing them down the street. You know, we thought it was part of the neighborhood, you know, because it was illegal to shoot dice in the streets. That's how it was back in the Depression days when I was a baby, yeah.
Did they have a look about them that was different from the look of the other mothers and fathers in the neighborhood?
No, they just ran faster than most people. they ran a little faster. They usually were young guys, 18, 19, 20, whoever. Maybe they turned up to be mastermind criminals later on, who knows.
Now, I want to ask you about one of the episodes of The Sopranos. One of the subplots here, you had a younger girlfriend, and you performed oral sex on her, not on camera, but and that is apparently not something that you're supposed to do if you're an Italian man, according to the Soprano scripts. So when word gets out that you're doing this, you have to give her up because the whole thing is so embarrassing. What was your reaction to that storyline?
As a character, you mean, or as Dominic?
Both. As yourself and as the character.
I saw the humor in it. It's very funny, I think. I was getting a big ribbing from Jimmy. I remember he said, "Wait, hit her. Did you read the episode?" Yeah, I said, "Not yet." He said, "Will you read it?" He said, he started laughing. And they will tease me. Oh, you're going to love this one, Dominic, you know. All the guys tease me about it. My reaction was that I thought it was very clever. And yet, as funny as it is, there's a lot of meaning to it, I thought, because Uncle Junior probably, I always wonder why, first of all, he never married, right? I noticed he never married Junior. And probably his sex life is very, very, very private to him. You know, like most men, I think, Italian men. And she was younger. And I think his pride was probably upset as a man, you know. So my reaction was that it's very good. It's a good gimmick. And he probably would get angry with her because he warned her not to say anything. And I guess he's a bit of a controller. I just think it's very normal, I think, you know. Hey, I'm a good Catholic kid. I can't go into it too deeply.
Were you at all embarrassed by this subplot?
Oh, no. God, no. No, Robin Peterson was such a wonderful actress to work with. God, she was funny. She was great, I thought, you know.
Dominic Chianese speaking with Terry Gross. He plays Uncle Junior on the HBO series The Sopranos. We'll hear more of their conversation after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back now to our interview with actor Dominic Chianese. He plays Uncle Junior on The Sopranos. The HBO series' new season begins on Sunday.
Now, let's talk about an earlier movie that you were in, Godfather 2, in which you play Johnny Ola, one of Hyman Roth's associates. And he's the guy that Pentangeli describes to Michael Corleone as Hyman Roth's Sicilian messenger boy. Mm-hmm. He's also the guy that Fredo says he was talking to, which tips off Michael that Fredo has been betraying the family by working with Hyman Roth. Would you describe your character of Johnny Ola?
Yeah, Johnny Ola was Hyman Roth's most trusted confidant, and any setups with the Corleone family as far as trying to eliminate them as rivals would come through Johnny because he knew how to handle Fredo Corleone. He knew that Fredo had a weakness, and he found that weakness, you know, and used jealousy to. Because if you think about Godfather, Fredo was, he even says it in the movie. He was bypassed by Pop, by their father, and I think that's something you can always use. You can turn brother against brother with that.
I want to play a scene from Godfather 2 where here you are as Johnny Ola in a restaurant with Michael Corleone, played by Al Pacino.
The casino you're interested in. The registered owners are Jacob Lawrence, Alan Barkley, both Beverly Hills attorneys. The real owners are the old Lakeville Road Group from Cleveland and our friend in Miami. Maya Klingman runs the store. He owns a piece of it, too. He does all right. But I've been instructed to tell you that if you move Klingman out, our friend in Miami will go along.
It was very kind of him. You tell him. That's greatly appreciated.
Hyman Roth always makes money for his partners. One by one, our old friends are gone. Death, natural or not. Prison, deported. Hyman Roth is the only one left. Because he always made money for his partners.
And that's Dominic Chianese as Johnny Ola in Godfather 2. How did you get the part of Johnny Ola?
Well, Francis, earlier, before they had done Godfather 1, he called a lot of people down at the Gulf and Western building down on 57th Street, 59th Street, years ago, 1971, I guess, and had a long, maybe a good half-hour conversation with Francis. He was a young filmmaker with just, you know, a few films under his belt and hadn't done Godfather 1 yet. And we discussed for at least a half an hour. He asked me many intimate questions about where I was, how I grew up, was my family from Italy, which part of Italy they come from. Basically, it was really my first film I had ever done. I'm theater trained. And then I went to Boston to do a play. And Jeff Hunter called me one time. He said, Dominic, you know, they're interested. Are you interested in coming down to New York to audition for him? They may be interested in you. And I said, no, I really don't. I said, I'm in Boston here with my wife and the kids at the time. I don't want to be in a film, you know. So I turned down The Godfather, one thing. Later on, I found out through Francis, he was very nice. He said, no, Dominic said, we had you in mind for this part, you know. But I figured I'd use you in case we ever did a sequel. And I said, wow, I'm glad you did, Francis. So looking back, I realized, Terry, that he wanted actors who could play these characters who were, and if these actors were unknown on the film, all the better for the realistic look.
Mm-hmm.
So I realized that I was just in the right place at the right time. I was just the right age, too. I was 40 when we did Johnny, I think. I did Johnny Oldie, yeah. And French was a very young man, and Al was a very young man.
How did you get your part on The Sopranos? Had David Chase seen you in The Godfather? I mean, in Godfather 2, was that part of the reason why you were cast?
Oh, no, I imagine that when George Ann Walken and Sheila Jaffe...
Oh, the casting directors, yeah.
They casting directors. They brought me in, and I'm just the right age for Uncle Junior. And David hadn't known me. And the second callback, I remember, as I was auditioning, I heard this real laugh, you know, like a kind of a quiet laugh, which I thought was very real. It wasn't a phony kind of thing. Sometimes producers try to relax you, you know, but he really laughed, I could see. And I said, I have a good choice for this. I strictly auditioned, Terry.
What was the audition scene you had to do?
It was that first scene with Nancy Marchand, with Livia, in the car. We had a read about that. When I said to her, you know, your son is, we may have to do something about your son. You know, it's funny, but yet it's very, very, very compelling scene, actually. And I didn't read with Nancy, but it was it's an excellent scene. It's the last scene in the episode, of the first episode, where he's in a car with her and he's casting aspersions on her son and talking about the difference between the old-time mobster, Johnny, her husband, and her son, who seems to be out of hand. He's laying the groundwork to get rid of it. And then, of course, she picks up on it, Livia.
Well, why don't we actually hear that scene?
Oh, that's a great scene, I think, yeah.
It's nice of you to pick me up for the party, Junior. At least somebody cares about me.
These kids today.
I suppose he thinks once he's got me locked in a nursing home, I'll die faster. And then he won't have to drive me anywhere. Well, if his father was still alive, you can bet your boots he'd show more decency and respect for his mother.
My brother John was a man among men.
He was a saint.
Anyway, lots of things are different now from Johnny's in my day.
What do you mean?
I'm not free to run my business like I want.
Oh, isn't that awful?
Just this week, your son stuck his hand in, made it 100 times more difficult for me. Plus, he thumbs his nose at New York.
Oh,
what are you gonna do? He's part of a whole generation. You remember the crazy hair? And the dope? Now it's fags in the military.
Stop it, Junior. You're making me very upset.
I don't like to, Olivia, but I'm all agita all the time. And I'll tell you something else. Things are down, all across the board. A lot of friends of ours are complaining. We used to be recession-proof. No more. Can't blame it all on the Justice Department. Our friends say to me, Junior, why don't you take a larger hand in things? Something may have to be done, Livia, about Tony.
As an actor, what do you like about the writing on The Sopranos?
The connection with a life They don't seem to ever to have, you know, God forbid, a funny line for the sake of a funny line, or they're well motivated lines. The subtext is always there for me, and that's a sign of good writing. You know where it's coming from, and the more you think about the line, sometimes you realize, well, there's a better way of doing it too. You know, because it's sort of like those three-dimensional chess games. You know, you're looking at the top, but then there's something underneath, and there's moves you can make down there too. It's that kind of thing about acting that is really challenging to me, Terry, and I think theater trains us to. Because if you do a show, let's say you open the show, and then two months later you're halfway into the run, or you're into the run for 2 or 3 months, and you realize, oh my gosh, you know, this is what the character's really saying. It's that kind of organic acting, I think, that the script allows, and that's important, I think.
Dominic Chianese speaking with Terry Gross last year. He plays Uncle Junior on The Sopranos, which begins its fourth season this Sunday on HBO. Chianese's new CD of Italian and American songs is called Hits. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Perché mi dichi sto parole amar? Perché me parli o cuore mi dormiente cadarì? Non te scorda che t'ha giudato cuore cadarì? Non te scorda. Cadarì, cadarì, che ben a dicere sto parlò a me da spase me. Tu non ci pensas stu dolore mi, tu non ci pensi tu. Non tieno cor, core, cor ingrato, t'hai pigliato a vita mia.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By Audi and the all-new A4 Cabriolet, available October 2002. Open up your world. Information at AudiUSA.com. And Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The Art of Forgiveness, Loving Kindness, and Peace by Jack Kornfield, author of A Path with Heart. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more Sopranos. We hear from actor Steven Van Zandt, who plays hitman Uncle Silvio, and Edie Falco, otherwise known as Carmela Soprano. And David Edelstein reviews the new theatrical release of the 1927 classic silent film, Metropolis. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's continue our archive edition on the HBO series The Sopranos, which starts its new season on Sunday. Edie Falco has won two Emmys for her portrayal of Tony Soprano's wife, Carmela. Before The Sopranos, Falco appeared in another HBO series, Oz, as corrections officer Diane Whittlesey. She's often performed on stage and is currently starring in the Broadway revival of Frankie and Johnny at the Claire de Lune. Falco also appeared in the Broadway show Sideman and recently starred in the John Sayles film Sunshine State. Let's hear a clip from the last season of The Sopranos. Carmela's difficult mother-in-law, Livia, has just died. The extended family is assembled after the funeral, and Tony's sister, Janice, has forced everyone into the awkward situation of sharing a remembrance of Livia. Carmela has been drinking several glasses of wine. Finally, she speaks up.
This is such a crock of s***.
Carmela.
I'm sitting here thinking I should protect my children from the truth about their grandmother on the one hand. On the other, I'm saying to myself, what kind of example am I setting? Evading and smiling, passing out cheese puffs over a woman that we all know was terribly dysfunctional, who spread no cheer at all.
Carmela, be quiet.
This is my house.
I'm leaving.
Let her talk, goddammit.
Get down!
No, I'll speak if I want. Goddammit, who are you? Minister of Propaganda? We suffered for years under the yoke of that woman. Years! She estranged us from our own daughter. Ruined. I don't know how many goddamn Christmases. I don't want to even begin to count.
You.
No, don't hand me that. Bullshit! You wanted it, you got it.
Terry spoke with Edie Falco last year when she asked about creating Carmela's personal style, whether it was putting on the hair, the nails, or the gold necklaces that transformed Falco the most.
I would have to say it's the nails. There is something very, like, I couldn't be more different from Carmela in this respect in particular, that I'm always building something or painting something or chopping wood or some such nonsense, and you put those nails on and it becomes very clear what a different class or something of person that she is, how she is physically incapable of doing these things that I do regularly. You know, the heels and tight-fitting clothing and big hair and makeup where you can't really touch your face and jewelry that feels uncomfortable to me. But this is all very much a part of who she is. So it takes me a certain degree of time to get ready to shoot. And in that period of time, I definitely feel a transformation take place. But I don't know that it's anything, you know, miraculous about me. I truly believe that, you know, if my father was to put on the fingernails and the hair, that he would end up becoming Carmela after 2 hours as well.
When you met James Gandolfini, who plays your husband Tony Soprano, had you seen him in anything else before?
Sure. He was one of those actors you always think, oh, good, he's in this. He's great. He scared the hell out of me when I found out that he was the guy playing my husband, because previous to that, I'd seen him beat a bunch of people up, and, you know, he'll kill me for saying this, but he played a lot of tough guys and a lot of mean guys, and, you know, they're like, yeah, this is the man you'll be going to bed with in this show. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So I was basically afraid. But he's the one who made the initial phone calls to introduce himself when he found out who was cast and that he wanted to have lunch so we could get to know each other. And I realized, okay, that's right, he's just an actor, that perhaps he's, you know, not the mean guy that I've seen in all these movies. And, you know, needless to say, that is very much the case, that he's a lovely guy.
Yeah, in a way, I figure you became an actress to get away from the kind of suburban life and neighborhood that you grew up in, and now you're famous for playing it, for embodying it.
It was funny that the first bunch of roles that I got professionally were playing waitresses, which is, what I did for 15 years to support myself. It seemed like a cruel joke, but I don't know that I ever really wanted to leave my suburban upbringing. I mean, you wanted to move to the big city as a young kid, and knowing that's where you have to go to be an actress and all that. But I guess it is sort of funny that I ended up kind of back in that environment. But I was never in any huge rush to leave it.
How many years did you waitress before you were able to make a living as an actress?
Oh, on and off for, I guess, 20 years probably, from, you know, my first waitressing job to my last, probably covered a span of 20 years. And I was so unhappy. You know, the jobs varied in difficulty and in income and clientele and all that kind of stuff. But I was so unhappy and just got more so as the years went by. It was the only way I knew to make a living and still have time available to go to auditions and classes and all that stuff. But I was just miserably unhappy. And I was sure that it would never end. I remember going to Sunday brunches, you know, to set up the restaurant and think, this is my life now. From the rest of my life, this is what I'll be doing. And I still have moments where I wake up and realize that I don't have to set up a restaurant on a Sunday morning. I will still walk past a restaurant with a sign that's saying, you know, help wanted, and think, oh, that's a pretty busy lunch crowd. I should check in there, you know. I wonder if that will ever completely go away. I can't say for sure that it will.
What was the worst part of waitressing?
Occasionally, I would be recognized for some small film that I had done or a theater performance, and for some reason it upset me tremendously. I prefer to kind of put on my waitress face, you know, my sort of, you know, worker face while I was doing this stuff. I'll bring you your drinks and I'll bring you your food and I'll tell you the specials if I'm in a good mood. And I don't want to be recognized as a human even. I sort of felt like if I'm an actress, that's what I want to be doing. I want to be walking down the street getting my coffee when someone recognizes me, as if when I'm acting, that's what I do and that's all I do. Or I don't know. I'm having to discover this as I'm talking about it as to why it would affect me the way it did. But that is definitely the way it affected me. I hated it. And I occasionally even denied it, that I was the person they thought I was.
Hmm. Do you think you learned anything about people by waiting on them? Things you could draw on for performances?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There were certain stereotypes of people. Depending on the area in which I waitressed or the time of day, it was frightening how predictable sometimes it would be. I mean, there was a certain echelon of individual who I despised. God, getting into this, I should probably shut up at this point, but where they would never make eye contact with you. Mm-hmm. They would come in and you'd, can I get you something? Can I get you a drink? And they would not so much as glance in your direction. They would, they'd ask you a question. They'd be still looking at the person they're with or like pointing to something on the menu, and they would not so much as look up. I became evil towards the end of this whole thing, so I don't know how much was them and how much was me.
Do you tip well now?
Oh, God, I do. I'm a little over the top, but, you know, there are worse things. You know, you live literally dollar to dollar when you're waitressing, and I remember times when I was working, I would work from, the shift was from 4 to 4, if you can believe this, 4 p.m. to 4 a.m. was one of the first jobs that I had. And I remember having to go home with $24 after that many hours, and I would have to spend $10 taking a cab home because I lived up by Columbia University at the time, and the restaurant was way downtown. So, you know, 12 hours of my life for 12 bucks or whatever, so... outrageous, but years and years were spent like that. And to know that a person is not expecting more than whatever it is, 16% or something, and to give them a nice big tip, you know what? It used to make my day. So it's the very least I can do. It's an interesting thing when dating that me and female friends have talked about. The first really big thing you learn about the guy you're dating is how he treats waiters and waitresses at a restaurant, and what a huge effect that will have on the rest of the relationship, or it's longevity, you know. It's a big thing for me. These people are doing a job, you know, and for the most part, as far as I'm concerned, an unpleasant one, and the least you can do is be polite.
Well, Edie Falco, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
Edie Falco, from an interview Terry recorded last fall. Falco plays Carmela Soprano on the HBO series. She's currently starring on Broadway in the revival of Frankie and Johnny at the Clair de Lune. Coming up, musician and Sopranos hitman Stephen Van Zandt. This is Fresh Air. Stephen Van Zandt co-stars in The Sopranos as Silvio Dante, hitman and owner of the Bada Bing strip club. Van Zandt is also the guitarist in Bruce Springsteen's band. Like Springsteen, he's from New Jersey, and that's where they met in the 70s. In the mid-80s, he left Springsteen's E Street Band to pursue a solo career. And although he returned to the band, he continues to make solo albums. Van Zandt is on Springsteen's new album, The Rising, which came out this summer. He's currently on tour with Springsteen. This spring, he launched his own nationally syndicated radio show, Little Steven's Underground Garage.
If you are just tuning in, you missed 17 of the coolest rock and roll songs ever recorded. Because that's our format here. You are in the Underground Garage, and in spite of all evidence to the contrary, I am Little Steven. We're on the Hard Rock Cafe.
Steven Van Zandt's first band back in 1966 was called The Source. When Terry spoke with him this summer, she asked him who his band played for.
We had dozens and dozens of places to play. High schools, obviously. We had the beach clubs because we were on the Jersey Shore. VFW halls. There was a television show called Hullabaloo, which had Hullabaloo clubs. There was three of those clubs in New Jersey where we played. There was teenage nightclubs built specifically for teenagers, a place called Le Teen Des Vous. Just a lot of places, right? Especially before in that, you know, magical sort of period there from 65 to about 67, 68, before drugs really made it to the suburbs. And when then once drugs came to the suburbs, all the teenage places got closed down.
How does performing in your 50s compare with performing in your 20s?
Well, you know, it's a lot more fun.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Why is it?
Because you don't care anymore. you don't care about anything particularly. You know, you just, there's not a lot of anxieties. You're not struggling, you know. You're not really trying to prove anything. You are who you are, and you better be pretty much at ease with that by now, or you are a mess. Mostly good stuff, you know what I mean? I mean, there's a lot of, when you're starting out, there's just a lot of, you know, you're struggling, you don't know whether you're going to make it or not, you don't know quite where you're going, or are you doing the right thing, or all those, you know, thousands of questions you have as a kid. You know, at this point, you know, they've all pretty much been answered, you know. And as far as we're concerned, I don't know if this is true for everybody, but I mean, I'm able to go on stage with the same attitude as I've always, you know, since I was 15, which is, you know, I fully intend to do the greatest show anyone's ever seen. And I don't even consider anything less than that, you know. I think we all sort of feel that way.
Now, one of the things about the Springsteen band is that on stage there's always a lot of, like, male bonding action, you know. Springsteen and Clarence Clemens, or you and Springsteen looking at each other, and there's this, you know, this is kind of like bonding going on on stage. Is that something that you kind of planned out before, or is that just, like, chemistry that happens on stage?
No, we have a few weeks of bonding sessions before a tour.
Bonding rehearsals.
We go into the woods and sort of, you know, beat drums and bond. No, I think that's the band thing. You know, I mean, we're as close to a band as you can be, even though it's a solo artist, being Bruce Springsteen. And that's part of the band phenomenon, is that communication of friendship and family and, you know, the artificial family that McLuhan talked about, you know. But it's just it's the phenomenon that got started by the Beatles and the thing that everybody responded to. That new thing. It was a new concept, the concept of a band, you know.
My guest is Steven Van Zandt. He's the guitar player in Bruce Springsteen's band, and on The Sopranos he plays Silvio Dante, hitman and owner of the Bada Bing Club. Let's hear him in a scene from The Sopranos. Tony has been trying to break up with his Russian girlfriend. He sends Silvio to give her the message that Tony's through with her.
How you doing, hon?
Who sent it you, Tony?
Yeah, he asked me to bring you this.
What is that, money? I don't want it.
Yes, you do. There's $75,000 in here.
75?
Listen, Irina, I know you're upset. Let me give you a little advice. My business, I see girls come and go. So I know time is the great enemy. You got a very short window. It's not good to get too hung up on any one thing. On the other hand, something new always comes along. I've seen it a million times. It's called The Passages. You know, it's a book.
Now, your character wears this kind of tall hairpiece.
Are you suggesting that's not my real hair?
Yeah, right.
Is that what you're suggesting?
Like, that's a big surprise, yeah. So whose idea was it to have, like who designed, who gave the hairpiece the look? Who came up with the idea that you'd wear one and that it would have that kind of, like, thick, high, rug-like kind of quality to it?
Well, once the, you know, David and I agreed that the character was going to be the sort of throwback to the past. Philosophically, you know, then he also should reflect that physically. So, you know, I wanted to make sort of a 50s looking guy, you know, a guy who never really left the 50s, and that was it. You know, in other words, he's not particularly concerned with fat being fashionable or being taking part in the modern world at all. You know. So that was it. Once we decided that, the rest was easy. You know, went and found a special tailor, my boy Joe Camellia, who in the past had done some clothes for various characters. Let's leave it at that. And you know, made sure the clothes were right and the look was right and. You know, that made it a lot easier for me because I really am a outside-in sort of actor. You know, I mean, I need to look in the mirror and see the guy. You know.
Now, in The Sopranos, you wear that hairpiece. In your own performances, you wear a bandana on your head. How did you start doing that?
It was a car accident where I got damaged a bit and. My hair never really grew in properly from that moment on. And I wasn't sure which way to go with it, you know. So I just started wearing the bandana rather than getting into the wig thing. It just didn't feel right at the time. And it just sort of stuck, you know, sort of became my thing, accidentally, really. So it paid off nicely, actually, in the end, because now you really can... I mean, if some other characters come along, if some of the movie parts or whatever ever came along, which they may or may not, I can very easily be somebody very, very different just from changing the hair, you know.
Right.
Which I like. You know, I really do like that aspect of it, you know, being a different person physically.
When you were creating your character, and even now that your character is, you know, has been around for a few years... Did you feel like you should be observing wise guys where you could so that you'd be creating a character based on real life and not just based on movies? Or did you think the thing to do was to look at all the movies and base it on movies, which is what Sopranos is?
Well, yeah, it's interesting because it ended up being a bit of both. But I think the thing to keep in mind at this point is I think... modern day, you know, mob guys are very, very aware of the movies, which we talk about in the scripts, you know. That's a fact. I mean, a lot of the Godfather in particular was something that is well known now, well documented as teaching many mob guys how to be mob guys in a way. So... you know, it's a postmodern consciousness going on here, where you're very aware of, you know, the movies that are, even though it's fictional in our case, the fictional characters are themselves watching the movies. So, I think watching the movies was part of it. I went back and watched them all, which I was a fan of anyway, and I knew them all pretty much by heart anyway. But I went back and back to all the way back to whatever, Public Enemy and, you know, Scarface and those things, and reread all the books and all that. But as far as real life, I mean, I grew up in New Jersey in bars, you know, and they were there. I mean, whether they were the real thing or wannabes, you know, what's the difference? You know, you know, you're never going to really know.
Well, Stephen Van Zandt, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Stephen Van Zandt plays Silvio Dante on The Sopranos. He performs on the new Bruce Springsteen album, The Rising, and is currently on tour with the band. Terry spoke with him this summer. Coming up, the return of the classic silent film, Metropolis. This is Fresh Air. Fritz Lang's 1927 silent classic, Metropolis, has been digitally restored to something approaching the original three-hour version and is now playing in theaters accompanied by the original score. Film critic David Edelstein has seen it and has these thoughts.
On the first anniversary of the destruction of the World Trade Center, many of us New Yorkers spent the day contemplating a skyline robbed of its most potent symbols, which were also meant as symbols of the towering dominance of world capitalism. It was a good time to remember what skyscrapers meant to people who'd never seen them before, and what they still mean to those who see them, rightly or wrongly, as an affront to nature. By coincidence, American moviegoers have an unprecedented opportunity, for the first time in 75 years, to see Fritz Lang's Metropolis in a form that approximates its director's intentions. The movie was directly inspired by the skyline of Manhattan, which the Austrian Lang beheld in 1924 from a ship in New York Harbor. He told his wife, Thea von Harbau, that he envisioned a cityscape dominated by soaring towers of glass and steel, while far below, in cellars and catacombs, the workers whose labor sustained it were physically and spiritually crushed, almost literally turned into machines. The film they made in 1927 from von Harbau's script was a science fiction landmark, and its imagery has reappeared in works as diverse as The Bride of Frankenstein, Doctor Strangelove, Blade Runner, and The Terminator. But Lang's original three-hour cut played in German theaters only a week and never in the United States, where it was hacked up and rewritten. There was a further American desecration in the 1980s by the composer Giorgio Moroder, who gave Metropolis a rock and synthesized disco beat in the hopes of creating a new kind of head movie. Moroder's music had such a devastating impact because Metropolis is one of the greatest ballets ever put on film. And I don't just mean the staggering movements of the workers, whose limbs are choreographed to look like cogs and gears and pistons. I mean that if you subscribe to the view of architecture as frozen dance, then every frame is like a balletic gesture. Each skyscraper represents a futurist ideal of transcendence via machine. The city's sharp angles and vertical thrust is arrogantly anti-nature. It's down below that the movie's hero, Freighter, the pampered son of the builder of Metropolis, falls to his knees at the vision of the beautiful Maria, played by Brigitte Helm. She's bathed in heavenly light and surrounded by tall crucifixes as she prevails on the exhausted workers to rise up in the name of the proletariat? No. The mediator, someone to mediate between the hands of labor and the brain of the ruling class, someone who represents the heart. Okay, so you're thinking, huh? Marx and Engels would recognize some aspects of this vision, but they wouldn't have gone for the Christian mediator stuff. But Lang was hardly a communist or a man with much sympathy for violent revolution. Part of what makes Metropolis such a complicated allegory is Lang's fear of the fascism of the mob, which he'd keep exploring in M and the American Fury. Maria is impersonated by a lewd and malevolent robot created by the mad scientist Rotwang. The robot is sent out to whip the underclass into destroying the machines. Lang understood why the mob would want to tear the city down, but he also believed that the technology it embodied promised a better life for people of all classes, and that violence solved nothing. It's no wonder that some people had no idea what Lang was trying to say, but that's good. I don't think there's anything wrong with packing as many contradictory longings into a single allegory. A great artist contains multitudes. Lang shows us the horror of the machine man, but he gives us in Brigitte Helm the sexiest robot of all time. He also gives us one of the screen's most charismatic mad scientists, Rudolf Kleinrog's Rotwang, who has helped to create the metropolis, yet has an insidious lust to destroy it, too. Most of all, Lang celebrates the power of architecture to elevate humanity, while he simultaneously laments its power to smother it. The movie is daft, but every frame is alive, and there are more frames now, thanks to German film preservationist Martin Kerber and the Munich company Alpha Omega, which did the digital restoration. This is still not the complete metropolis, but new titles tell us what we're missing, and the shape of the thing is as Lang intended. Try to see Metropolis as you ponder the 21st century skyline, its champions and its enemies, and consider that all these issues are being wrestled with in the context of a big, corny, often dumb commercial sci-fi epic, and what a marvelously elastic form it can be in the hands of an architect like Fritz Lang.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Kino International is releasing Metropolis on video and DVD early next year. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Aveda, maker of sustainably sourced hair, body, and lifestyle products, and proud supporter of NPR's environmental coverage. Information at aveda.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the struggle over wealth, power, and fairness that led to the income tax. We talk with Stephen Wiseman, author of The Great Tax Wars. Also, The Partly Cloudy Patriot. We talk with Sarah Vowell, contributing editor for This American Life. She has a new book. Join us for the next Fresh Air.